This podcast is supported by Podcast Labs, Bournemouth's full-service podcast production and marketing agency.
Hello, and welcome to the 10th Degree Podcast. I'm Anthony Story. Now, the most important thing for pretty much every company are the people who work there. Now, people can be lovely, but they can also be, well, trouble. Recruiting people right, to begin with, goes a long way to solving this. But also building teams is vital to make sure you get the best from your staff. Sue Pilgrim's got so much experience, both as an entrepreneur, but also as a recruiter. And she's got so much good advice, but it's clear and it's knowledgeable and really warm. I hope you enjoy the episode. And did you review us yet? If you haven't, I don't know, do you feel five stars in the air as much as I do? Anyway, enjoy the episode. So I'm here with Sue Pilgrim. Sue is a leader with over 30 years experience working in the recruitment sector.
That's right.
Spent 10 years as the group managing director of the Become Group, which is a specialist in, well, specializes in digital and creative sector. And you led international network across the UK and Asia Pacific.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Australia.
So you've managed to build the growth of the company turnover and profitability and helped become the business, become the verb,
yes,
an international market leader for digital and creative recruitment. Now, that's a challenging industry to come from. And I can already feel the panic rising up in some people's minds at the prospects of dealing with a recruitment agency because, oh my God, they want to charge 50% of the first year's salary just to hire one person.
Yeah.
But before we kind of get into that kind of
I wish I was charging that.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of going through some of the quotes I've had in the past going, okay, that seems all right. But just hold on for a second. So recruitment and HR is actually probably one of the most important aspects for any business, but also possibly one of the least understood as well. So I think it doesn't necessarily have that twinkly allure some of the other business departments have got. So most entrepreneurs don't see it as the area they've got to get their heads around in the same way that they definitely want to understand something about the marketing, and they realize they've got to get their head around business finances. And, you know, finance is not the spiciest of topics to get your head around. So if recruitment and HR is coming in after that, that's the pretty damning from the entrepreneur's perspective. So, but the reality is that for pretty much every business, people are the most important asset that they've got. There's nothing more important than your staff. So even if you're running a digital-only product, you still need people to upload content. You still need people to deal with customers or package products. And if those people aren't there or they're not happy, then you're soon going to get into some problems. And I'm coming to a question, so I'm going to get there. So now we know that ever since the invention of the customer service department, customer service has probably never really been worse. So the only thing you've got to save you are your people. But people are unpredictable. They often want to do things in their own way. And so the trouble that we have as a manager is we're not usually taught how to manage people. And it's not a topic that you're going to find at school. There's no teacher who's going to be teaching you, right, this is how to manage people. And so we don't know what the law is necessarily either. And we're not very good at handling difficult situations. So, so not for the first time, that's me going off on a bit of a tangent, but you're the expert here. So I'm going to come up with a question. How do you see the recruitment industry, and what's your experience of interacting with other people who are dealing with you in it?
Wow. Thanks for that introduction. Excessive introduction. There's a lot in there. I think having been in recruitment now for over 35 years, I think the first thing to say is how significantly it's changed during that period of time. And sadly, much to my embarrassment, not necessarily for the better, recruitment should be all about relationship building. And it certainly was sort of pre-computers, the job sites, etc. That was the only way, basically, that you could deliver a service, was by meeting your clients and meeting your customers. I think to a certain extent, There are still some very, very good people out there, but I think to a certain extent there's been a deterioration in the service as it's become commoditized and it's become more computerized. I can't think of a better word now. Mm-hmm. I think from my own experience, you mentioned the creative business. You know, I'd spent 20 years before that cutting my teeth in high street recruitment and also in specialist recruitment in the healthcare and social care sector, which are quite demanding sectors. But I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it once I came into the creative sector. And I think the key and the difference, which is why we made such a difference to the sector, was that the people that I recruited to work in that business, my consultants, had creative backgrounds. So they actually understood, you know, had a studio manager, had a trafficker, had graphic designers. They used to call themselves failed graphic designers, but they understood what they were doing. And they were people, they were interested in design, they were interested in technology. And I think that's what made the difference. They wanted to go out there and meet their clients, and they wanted to go out and wanted to meet all candidates. And sadly, a lot of recruitment today, people don't even meet with people. It's all done literally over the internet. I'm forgetting what your question was now.
Well, no, it's just more kind of like a general comment, sort of in terms of that, I suppose, how people
adding
view
the value.
It.
And,
I mean, it's interesting. Let's pick up on that. I mean, how do you go about recruiting the right people?
Yeah,
it's interesting that as a recruitment company, you seem to practice what you preach.
Yeah, and that is actually very, very, very difficult because recruitment itself has one of the highest turnovers for staff going. Just talking about value, if I can just slip back to you were talking about, you know, paying big fees and that kind of thing. We used to have a lot of that in recruitment generally, but in my creative business, we did an exercise in all of the locations, with the exception of Hong Kong, because that had only just opened in 2014, to see how long the people that we placed were actually still in situ. And we did it for 5 years. We said, let's go back 5 years. We did it for 3 years in Sydney because it's a slightly more transient marketplace. But you'd be amazed that over, I think it was something like 65-70% of people from London and Manchester were still with that business 5 years later. That's how good the matching, the quality had been. We also did another exercise to look and to see, where are people? We said, what have they become? We used our name, obviously. So we had people like juniors, etc., but now art directors or creative directors. So we got their story as well. So we're very much about the relationship. How do you go about recruiting our own people?
So if you're getting really good retention rates in terms of, you know, people, you're getting the right person to go into the job. What steps can somebody take in order to try and ensure that works?
It's a twofold thing for us. I'm talking about the creative recruitment business that I had now. As I say, it was very much about taking on people with experience in the industry. And we would take people on either grad level or at quite senior level. I was very keen on, I ran an internal training academy. So I was very keen on nurturing and growing our own. Because we found if we took people from other recruitment agencies, we were often inheriting bad habits. So then what we would do is we would create a culture whereby people could learn and they felt safe. We didn't have a blame culture. We had a culture where if something went wrong, you fessed up to it and learnt from it. Yeah. And that started right from the top with me. I mean, nobody's perfect. And I think for the period of time, I mean, I sold the business 3 years ago. I'm not sure, you know, what it's like now, but I do know that several of the key people are still there and still some of them have been promoted as well. So it's obviously we did something right. I think it's about finding the people that have got the right values in the first place. And that's really, it's easy to say, but it's really difficult. But then inducting them properly. Let's give you an example in Hong Kong. Oscar's still there, I believe, 5 years later. He was a local Hong Konger who was recruited before the office opened, and we sent him over to Sydney, was the nearest office. So we sent him over to Sydney for 2 weeks, and then he went into Melbourne. So he could get the DNA of the company. So he could meet all the people, he could understand how we worked, he could realize the values and the importance of developing long-term relationships. And then I went out with Oscar myself into Hong Kong, completely virgin territory. We'd not been in Asia at all. And we sat with clients and we said, look, we're not here for a quick buck. We're here for the long term. Hopefully we can help you. If we can't help you, we'll let you know. If we don't get it right, we need you to let us know. So it's very much about relationship. And that's what we're looking for in our own people. You've got to, I think, if I'm looking for a client, you know, and this is a while since I actually recruited for clients, but when I was recruiting for clients, I'd always want to go and see them. If it was a complicated role, I wanted to spend some time with them, going through actually what the role entailed, but also looking at the day-to-day tasks, the people they would interact with. So I had a really, really good understanding of not just the role itself, but also the kind of person that would fit in. And unfortunately, I think that's when you don't have the interaction, the people side of it, that's the bit that gets lost.
One of the things that I hear, especially when you're recruiting people in for earlier in their careers, is that, you know, pretty much every employer you ever talk to says that when somebody comes in from university, it takes at least a year until they're ready to do the job. You know, there's a long period of time where people have to come in and learn how to work because they've never really learned how to do that properly. So when you know, and people often talk about skill shortages, you know, particularly in certain areas around technology as being one of them. But when it comes down to it, fundamentally what they're looking for with pretty much all of their appointments are a good fit. And the majority of that is based around someone's ability to have the right soft skills. So it's
attitude.
It's not what they know, it's just who they are. And I was just wondering, is that an important element for, at what point, is there a point somewhere in someone's career where that ceases to be the important thing and actually you are employing somebody for their experience? Or if you are employing somebody just for their experience, is that where it goes wrong if you haven't got the personality to go with it?
I would always put attitude over experience. It's no matter whether it's somebody that's literally straight out of school or it's somebody that's got experience, you know, it's that fit that's more important. It's interesting you say about graduates. I took a risk in my Manchester business. We were struggling to find consultants, and there was a new apprentice scheme for 16-year-olds coming out of school instead of going on to do A-levels instead of going to uni. Now, traditionally, we'd never taken anybody less than a graduate, sort of 21, 22 years old. But we went on to this apprentice scheme, which was just run amazingly up there. And it was very, very successful. We took three apprentices on in the end. And I think they all stayed with us. I think one of them's only just left recently. But to go on to, you know, bigger things, left very amicably. And I would recommend always, if you've got a good training program in place and a good induction and a good culture that can cope with young people and support them, I would always recommend having them in your mix, definitely. I think if you just have all young people, then depending on what your business is, then that might make it quite vulnerable. I think it's good to have you know, talking about putting teams together, it's good to have a good group dynamic and to have a good mix of people, both in terms of age groups, but also in terms of skills and expertise, because obviously they will learn from each other. I mean, my newbies, the youngsters, or even somebody coming in would always be appointed not only a mentor, but also a buddy. Your mentor would help you with your training program. Your buddy would help you with where the coffee shop is, where the loos are, where you go for lunch, that kind of stuff. And that would normally be, if it was like a youngster, it'd be another youngster that was a few months ahead of you or something. So you've got to think about your team. And if you're going to invest the time in recruiting them, then you've got to invest the time in keeping them and making the environment conducive. I was brought up years ago to say, you know, you can't motivate someone, they have to motivate themselves. But what your role is as a leader is to provide that environment for them to feel that they want to come in every day and they want to do their best and they want to have fun and, you know, make things happen.
That's really interesting. Did you find that there were things that you could do that would help?
Yeah.
What sort of stuff did you
You can. Well, It's really little things most of the time. I'm going to sound a bit corny now, but it's literally remembering to say thank you to people.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. You'd be surprised how many people never say thank you in the workplace. You'd be surprised how many people walk into an office and never say hello. You know, they just come in and get their heads down and get on with what they're doing. It's the little things, the little common courtesies. And then you need, you know, you can have incentives and competitions. And if you're in recruitment, it's obviously, you know, a salesy environment. Even in creative, you know, it was still like we had targets to meet and stuff like that. So you can provide little competitions and fun ones just for the day. You know, first one to do, you know, get somebody out of that booking, you know, gets, I don't know, a gift voucher or a trip up to Carluccio's for, you know, lunch.
Yes.
Just little things.
I mean, I've heard some great ones. Some of the ones that some companies do, I think Adidas is one of them. They have somebody cooks lunch for everybody on a Friday.
Yeah, I'm not sure, kind of a monthly thing.
That
people bake cakes and things like that. Manchester used to bake cakes for each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is nice.
Are you a fan of the table tennis table and pool table, or do you think that's just a distraction?
I don't mind. I think, you know, again, you put it in the environment and then the people that that works for, that's great. And the other people that don't, it doesn't engage them. Well, that's fine. You know, they can do whatever it is, you know, that they need to do, whether it's go off for a half hour CrossFit or something like that. I don't know. But I think you can just, you know, what does it cost to provide a foosball table or something like that, or a, you know, a fridge full of beers? It's not a lot, really. But what you get back in terms of people, you know, enjoying and wanting to come to work, I think is, as long as people aren't abusing it, it is worth its weight, really.
Well, I heard, so the back in the 80s, I'm not sure if it's necessarily true, is that the Virgin, as it was, I suppose, kind of predominantly around the record company there, would it had a policy where it just tried to create a really nice vibe around the place. And they actually paid probably the lowest salaries around, but they used to throw an epic party every year.
Virgin was one of my clients back in the 80s. Yeah.
And, and everyone just kind of like thought, oh God, I'm here for the party, this is amazing, and forgot about the fact that they weren't being paid as much, which meant it is true. Okay,
it's true.
But
it's
as a company, that's amazing, isn't it? Because it means that, you know, the cost of the party compared to how much less you pay everybody is negligible. Yeah. So good for business.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, I used to provide, gosh, this is going back a long time now, late 80s, used to provide Richard Branson's office with their PA and secretarial staff. So the parties were legendary.
Right.
And all good fun. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, sometimes people will accept a sort of lower competitive salary to be in the right kind of environment. And sometimes, I mean, we're talking about creative people would want to work with certain brands. I mean, we would have candidates that would be very specific about, I want experience on that brand. I really want to work there. I don't mind if it's actually going to pay me slightly less than I'm earning now, because actually I need that. I really want to work with them. So it isn't always just about money.
So that can be quite a good tip if you're looking to try and recruit the right sort of people, is to really focus on what it is that you're doing in terms of what the product is. And I guess these days it's not always necessarily about the brand. It's there's a lot of talk about purpose as well, isn't there?
Yes.
Kind of within the brand circle. Yeah, so in terms of emphasizing, you know, the kind of the purpose of what you're trying to achieve, what the outcomes are, and very much in this sort of 21st century approach, it's not, I mean, well, I think one thing that's fair to say is that recruitment is never about, well, maybe never is too strong a word, but it's seldom about the money. It's more to do with, is the job interesting? Is it a good quality of life that I get through this? Or, you know, and especially, well, maybe that's kind of more early stages, but certainly the research I've done is that people are interested in being stimulated, challenged, and in a nice environment.
Yeah.
And the money is the cherry on the top, but seldom the motivator.
And I think the other key thing as well is technology. And people want to be in an environment where they can be, you know, keeping their skills up to speed. And you know, I started in recruitment back in the late 80s when freelancing or temporary work was still, you know, very much a sort of the thing that you did if you couldn't get a permanent job. And, you know, very much we were selling the concept of the more freelancing you do, the more opportunities you get to work in different in companies, actually, the better your skill set is. And so this started to develop what we know now as the professional freelancer. And, you know, and freelancers quite frequently earn more. I mean, I know there are times when they don't work, but equally, they are often much, much better skilled and more flexible and adaptable than a permanent member of staff. And that really started back in the late 80s when we had our first recession. I've actually worked in four recessions and came into recruitment in one of the biggest ones at the end of the 80s. And people realised that they had to go to a core, cut back to a core, and then have this flexible workforce. And that's when it was first sort of articulated, really, and promoted as a real sort of like a real choice, a real work and lifestyle choice. And it's interesting because having opened in Hong Kong back in 2014, I came across the same kind of culture that they still think it's still very much about having a permanent job, and still very much the freelance role is an interim between getting a proper job, in inverted commas. I think give it another 5 or 10 years, perhaps five actually, the way it's moving, I think, you know, they'll have caught up and actually people will be recognising the value of the freelancer.
So, I mean, sorry.
If that makes sense.
freelancers or employees, in terms of building a team, then we're talking about trying to employ people who have got the right fit, kind of mm-hmm. who have got the right personality. Is there a danger, if it is a danger?
That's your core team.
Yeah, is there a danger that you kind of end up with everybody just being the same inside the office, and as a result that nobody's really challenging everybody else? Yeah. And so I'm kind of thinking back into the, you know, the management books that say, right, you should have 8 different personality types on yeah. your board or your management team. And so, you know, ones kind of going into those Belbin type tests or whatever. Is that a danger, or do you think actually if everyone gets on with each other it doesn't really matter?
I think you're talking about everyone having the same, what I call the DNA, that same ethos, that same principle values. That doesn't mean they're the same people, they have different personalities, and obviously as long as you haven't got extremes in there or psychopaths or anybody like that, then, you know,
apart from the CEO, which is normally
apart from
a psychopath,
myself, clearly. Yeah, as you know, it's like it's a bit like a railway lines. You know, you've got a boundary, you've got parameters, and everyone can sort of like muddle along within there. And you have to sort of determine, well, you know, that person is, if they're outside, too far outside, then it won't work. But you're absolutely right. You do need a mix of people to make that dynamic work.
What do you think the most common thing is that people get wrong when they hire staff? Is there a sort of a... when does it go?
People don't reference people.
Okay.
And I say that because people will say things, and, you know, unless you reference them, you don't know whether what they're saying is true, you know. And unfortunately, a lot of companies and a lot of businesses don't reference people. So I would say that if something goes wrong, it's normally because you've just taken what someone said to you at face value and you haven't tested it.
How useful is a reference? Because you're not allowed to give a bad reference anymore, are you? In the UK, at least.
No, that's true. And it's a lot less liberal than it used to be. It used to be a lot easier to get a fair evaluation, a real evaluation of somebody. But even things like dates... dates that people worked are important. Even if you've got like a little checklist which has got attendance, sickness and things like that, that will flag up on a reference. Somebody, you'll pick up very quickly if actually somebody's, not attendance isn't good. And these will be the problems normally that flag up quite early on. If someone's not going to work out and guarantee they're going to be sick within the first 4 weeks, you've probably seen it yourself in businesses, but that's what will normally happen because someone, for whatever reason, it's not been the right appointment.
Yeah. What's been the worst experience you've had recruiting somebody or interviewing? In the interview, have you had like an interview that's just gone horribly wrong?
Gosh, an interview.
Shall I share one with me? For you?
Go on then. I just remember, I'm trying to think of one.
It was actually, I think it was more of a pitch than it was with an interview, but it was started by somebody coming in and doing a handstand.
Oh, and you think, well, this is different.
This is not usually what you get.
Yeah.
I mean, he was pitching an idea which was based around the gym, so I think it was kind of showing his progress. So
there was something in
it, but it was a kind of slightly kind of go, you know, kind of okay. Would that work in an interview situation? Maybe if you're going to. I've had one happen to me back years ago,
when in the late 80s, early 90s, when people were being very adventurous with interviews, trying to be a bit different, and I walked in and there was no chair.
Okay.
No chair at all. Not just like the low chair, you know, the chair that's practically on the floor kind of thing, but no chair at all, which is quite a challenge. So I.
Why? So
to make you feel uncomfortable.
Is the low chair a real thing? I mean, why do people do this?
They try. Well, it used to be this theory of making people feel uncomfortable.
Is that still I
don't think it is now. No, I'm talking about a long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I hope not, anyway. If there's anybody out there doing that.
And what about, because there are certain recruitment techniques, aren't there? I mean, I've sort of been at the end of it. And so one of the ones I've heard about is that if you, somebody's asking, it doesn't really matter what they're talking about, but you just kind of pick on something and just drill into it and drill into it and drill into it and drill into it.
Yeah, a rolling why, that's called. The rolling why.
Ah, okay. Yes. And it's a technique, but I remember it's a bit aggressive. I remember when somebody was talking, going, it's like going, why are you asking me this? This has got absolutely no relevancy to anything, and you're asking me something which I've already told you is not an area that I really focused on. So are those good techniques? And can you share any other ones?
That's quite generic. I think depends on the sector and what you're trying to establish. I mean, certainly from the creative recruitment point of view, I don't think it's really very useful. I mean, it's far more useful to sit down and have a conversation with somebody, look at their portfolio, talk about their work. An example with that, with a portfolio, is you need to understand people will come in and show work. Well, what piece of work? What was your contribution in this piece of work? What influence did you have over that? Because, you know, if we could see people from the same company all bringing in the same work and all saying that it was their work. So, you know, we've got to establish, well, what is what? But, you don't have to be aggressive about it. It's a conversation. It's probing gently, making people feel comfortable. People are much more likely to share information with you if they feel comfortable than if they feel on the defensive, which is why the rolling why and that sort of technique. It's very, if you've seen Wolf on Wall Street, yeah? And yep. You've seen the training sessions that he does. Now, I don't know if there's any sort of 80s, 90s recruiters listening out there, but believe you me, that's how we were trained back in the day. Which is why, obviously, you know, we can sell, but I think you have to move away from that sort of style, especially in specialist recruitment, because it'll only take you so far.
So you've gone through that process, you've got somebody on board, and then it starts to go wrong. And I know this is kind of getting more into HR than recruitment, but what steps can you take? What should you take when you're going, you know, I can't work with this person anymore, or you know, how do you deal with that?
Well, the first thing is you need to take responsibility for the person that you've recruited. So you have a plan in place for them. And again, a number of times I see people don't have a plan for a new starter. And that means, you know, they've got a mentor, they've got a buddy, they've got a program for the first 4 to 6 weeks, whatever it is for your business, your sector, however long it takes. They've got a point of reference every day, twice a day if necessary in the first week or so, to check in, somebody to actually, you know, look at their work, see what they've been doing. They've got small targets to achieve, whether in our case it would be people shadow interviewing. So you need to shadow interview the seniors. You know, you might need to do 10 of those in a week. Now, if someone's starting to slip back on shadow interviewing, and 10 in a week's not that difficult, it's only two a day, you know, and there's plenty of seniors interviewing all day, then the alarm bells would start to ring.
What do you mean by shadow interviewing?
Sitting in with a junior or a newbie, sitting in with a senior consultant, actually sitting in on the interview. So you're learning their approach, and you try and sit in with as many of the different consultants as possible, so you'll get picking up the different interview approaches and techniques, etc. I've done this myself in a very senior role as a operations director in social care business. I didn't have a background in social care, which you could say is a bit of a risk, but I literally immersed myself in shadow interviewing for the first 4 to 6 weeks with that business and sat in as many interviews as possible, because that's how you learn as well about the sector that you're going into. Okay. So that's what I mean by that. So you need to put a lot of effort and input into the people when they first start. Equally for somebody, if they're not a newbie, the same thing for someone that's more experienced. There are different things you might expect from somebody that's experienced over a different period of time, because obviously you'd expect them to come with a level of understanding, etc. And then what you do is you have milestones. So you have key milestones, and then you know from experience, and you know from where people should be benchmarked. You know whether people need, they're falling behind because actually they need a bit of help with something, or whether they're actually not engaged. And you will pick, if you're an experienced recruiter or working with teams, you will pick that up quite early on. You can also, of course, use your seniors or use your other team members that are the mentoring that to get their feedback, so that they can share with you, yeah, I think they're struggling with this because, but actually I think they're a good egg. They just need a bit more help with that. Or I'm really not sure, they've been late. They've not turned up to a couple of the interviews. They didn't come with me to the client, this sort of thing, which rings a few alarm bells.
I mean, a lot of the people in our world
catching it early.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the people in our world work in quite small companies.
Yes.
So it's hard kind of having, some of that can be difficult. Yeah. But when you get to the stage where you go, this is detrimental to everyone, yeah, is it possible to fire someone? Because the laws are so different from how they were in the 70s,
let's say. How
do you go about doing that without getting yourself in trouble?
Well, first of all, you technically have a probation period. So some companies have 3 months, seems to be quite typical. Other companies have 6 months. I used to have 6 months in my business. And what you do is if you're uncertain about somebody, you can extend a probationary period, but you need to question that really carefully, because you need to be saying, is that the right thing to do? Or is this person, not going to align with the business and it's not going to work? And so you have to start having open conversations. But if you've done what I said earlier about having those opportunities to meet with them every day, every week in those early stages, then you'll have already identified, 90% you'll have identified if there's any issues coming up. I can almost guarantee you that the problems that you get is when someone just hasn't been inducted properly or orientated into the business properly. Okay. I think that's when you get your problems, and it's Joe's not working out. Been here 3 months, but have we spent any time with him? No, let's give Joe a chance. Hey, we need to spend that time with him.
I want to ask a little bit about your business and kind of your experience in sort of being a leader and developing a business. But before we do that, I just thought, you've worked in across several countries, and you've had the whole Asia Pac, and you've been working in Australia. And I thought it would be useful in that just to try and get a sense of how much you've picked up on international employment law and what is and isn't permitted. So I was wondering, and compared to the UK, so is it acceptable to wear a silly hat in the workplace?
What, overseas or anywhere?
Anywhere.
I mean, certainly in the UK, certainly in Australia. But I would say,
What about New Zealand?
I worked in an education business in New Zealand, actually, and I didn't see many silly hats.
Because you get fined. You can get fined in New Zealand if you wear a silly hat in the workplace. do you have to allow people to have time to go to the bathroom or to get those bathroom breaks?
Yes. Yeah. Is this another legal?
But not in America. So in America, there's no legal statute for you to have to allow people to go to the loo which when you think about what the alternatives are, seems quite bizarre. But yeah, over here, you. So, I mean, in terms of the breaks, I mean, as a serious question.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I don't know specifically.
Do you
what
have
the
to give
are,
people like lunch breaks and tea breaks?
I believe so. Yeah, you do. I believe so. Yeah, and you know, there's the rules like things like that. You know, if it goes, it's too hot. Is it too hot or too cold? I don't know which way around it is. It's only one of them. If it's too cold, you can't stay. If it's too hot, it doesn't matter.
I think it's. I think you're allowed to be really cold because people work in refrigerated environments.
But you can't be too hot or something like that.
So, okay, and what about, can you force your staff to go on a health programme?
I would say no, but you're going to tell me somewhere in the world that they can.
Well, you've been working in the Far East, and in Japan, there is something called the Metabo Law, which means you, not to get this, you can measure people when they start working.
What, measure their height?
No, measure their girth. Oh. And if they're considered overweight, you can, and they don't do anything about it, you can make them go on dieting classes, which I thought was interesting, but probably not
intrusive.
Practical if you are running a sumo school.
Yeah,
I thought that could go wrong there.
So what? Okay, I think there's a point, isn't there, around cultural differences? And I think you look at somewhere like Hong Kong. There's a lot of drama in Hong Kong at the moment, but fundamentally, you know, it's a very vibrant and an active community.
How did you find setting up? Were you responsible for setting up the offices overseas? That was your
move.
So how did you find that? Which countries did you end up working in?
When I bought the business, that London and Manchester existed in Sydney, and I opened Melbourne. And did Melbourne, and then I opened Hong Kong, and Hong Kong was the first Asia operation, and the choice was really between Malaysia, Singapore, or Hong Kong. So I spent at least 12 to 18 months beforehand doing preparation. I did comparators, economic creative comparators, and then I did on site and visited. And, you know, Singapore's got a lot going for it, but it's much more of a financial sector, really, than creative. As soon as I stepped off the plane and got into Hong Kong, I felt like it was a bit more grungy. It was a bit more... this is happening.
Yeah, well, Singapore's pretty unique in that way, isn't it?
Yeah, and so Hong Kong felt like it was the better place to be. And I also got a lot of support from UKTI, from the UK Trade and Industry, both in the UK and over there, and from the British Council as well. So we were just very, very open for business and for trade. But I was going to say we would have people working in the offices, and the offices and where I stayed in my apart hotel, for example, was actually bigger than where my business manager lived with both his mother and his girlfriend. Space is such a premium right in the centre. And people would be in their offices, you know, using the showering facilities because it was less crowded than being perhaps at home. And people would stay, the lovely facilities in the offices, people would stay and use the internet because obviously it's crowded at home. So there are some real stories about how life is quite different because of how people live in such a smaller space, such a busy space.
And understanding those cultural differences is essential, I guess, in terms of successfully opening up.
Exactly.
And you was it word financial comparators, you said? So that sounds...
Economic, creative and financial comparators.
Okay. So that sounds like quite a bit of planning. I mean, how do you... Yeah. So you mentor quite a lot of people now as well.
I do, yes.
How do you find people are in terms of the planning of their businesses?
Yeah, I think people are very... I'm really impressed by how entrepreneurial people are and how enthusiastic they are and how good ideas come out. But I think what people tend to lack is that sort of planning element of it. And actually, I completely understand that because my recruitment background originally was very, very corporate. It was some of the big high street names that like drill the training and all this sort of thing into you. And unless you've had that exposure, I think, you know, it's very difficult to actually understand how to go about putting a business plan together, whether it's to market your new product, whether it's to open a new office, whether it's to go overseas, whatever it is to do. So I've found that most of the time that I spend with my mentees is usually around putting together a plan, whether it's for their existing business or whether it's for a new revenue stream or something that they want to do. And I think because I've had a lot of exposure to that and very experienced at that, I think that's where I can bring some real value. Mm. I think what people do is underestimate the amount of time they need to put into a plan and into preparation. And you don't want to, I think people are frightened if they plan for something, it becomes inflexible. So I think they think that then they can't actually change it. So I think it's almost like you do a plan, but you do it, I call it, on parallel levels. So you have like this plan, then you have, if that deviates there, it's almost like a flow chart really, rather, you know, then this happens or that happens. So you've got lots of different...
Plan A, plan B, plan C.
Yeah, exactly. So, and having like, you know, worked in recessions, for example, you know, I remember going into the financial one in 2008, into nine, wasn't it, 2008-09. And that one happened very, very quickly, that recession, compared with other recessions, in terms of, you know, losing business sort of overnight, which is quite challenging. And I remember in, you know, that situation having like two or three different plans before we got down, for example, making losing staff. And that's the, that was my key, was not to lose my staff. My staff, the people that worked in the creative recruitment business, were the key to my business. That's all you've got in a recruitment business. And I'm proud to say I didn't lose anybody. We'd even got down to like potentially salary sacrifices before we got down to losing people. And so we weathered the storm and we kept everybody.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was actually, because an awful lot of competitors did lose people. But that was because I planned it. Mm. Yeah, okay, you know, we did other things as well. But it didn't mean I just had to jump from X, you know, A to B. So I actually had different stages that I could go through.
When you talk about planning, what should be in that plan? Because I've heard you say before that some people say these days it's just not very fashionable to plan.
Yeah.
So at the risk of being very not on trend at the moment and thinking about planning, what are the key things that should be included in the plan?
Well, I think you need to know where you're going. You need to know what it is you want to achieve. So you've got to have some kind of vision, you know, and whether that's a product, whether it's a service, you've got to know, you know, roughly what you're heading for. I think you've got to be very clear about what you're good at, what your USP is, because especially with entrepreneurs who are so full of ideas, I mean, they shoot off all over the place, which is brilliant, but you know, only one of those things is going to really give you a profitable, successful business. So you need to be very disciplined. You need to start, once you've got those sort of strategic points in place, you need to put in then the resources and the structure and the time frame. So you need to have some kind of like loose, start off loose and then work down into the detail. And it's almost a bit like a Gantt chart then. So if I'm going to open a business, you say to me, you're going to open something in 2 years' time. So I'll start off with the end result and I'll work backwards. And then I'll work down to a plan for, okay, what do I need to do every quarter? How does that break down into every month? How does that break down into every week? And then what are the tasks that need to be doing? So it can get very, very detailed. And I would imagine if it's, you know, a product or a manufacturing business that you're in, that you would need to be that detailed. Perhaps if it's more service orientated, it could be a little bit less particular. Okay. But then you put everything into that, resources, marketing, finance, everything.
So, and then again, I think, you know, interesting what you said, but if you need to change it, don't be afraid of changing
Absolutely.
It. Just sort of, but keep making, understand why you have to change it.
Yeah. And I think the other important thing you just reminded me is knowing your, what I call your break-even point. So knowing the cost of things to your business. So understanding, for example, how much money you need to be bringing in before you take on that extra member of staff. And then you add in another person. Because what will automatically happen when you immediately add somebody in is you will dilute the productivity of the people that you already have. So there'll be a period of time when it's diluted before then they're actually contributing. And then you're back up to a point where then you need another member of staff. And again, it depends on what kind of industry that you're in.
Yeah, we had a chat with the financial director in one of the podcasts we've been doing. And it's just interesting in terms of trying to get that sense of understanding, I guess, value and risk of taking somebody on, and understanding when that's going to be paying back, and then actually trying to predict in the future in terms of not worrying about what the books say right now, but worrying what the book's going to be saying in 6 months' time, and then sort of trying to plan what you're doing for that future.
Yeah. It's quite difficult, especially if you're in an area that you're not particularly an expert in. I think if you're in an area that you know very well, like for me with recruitment, I would know very well what the productivity levels I'd expect from people after a certain period of time of given experience. So I would kind of know how to plan that out. But if you're actually in something that's quite new to you, then yeah, I understand that that might actually be quite difficult. But I think you could still try and put down milestones, still try and put markers in the sand to check yourself against. And of course, look at your competition and look at benchmarks, look at industry information. I did a lot of research when I'm opening things up or doing something new, looking at, you know, what the general market trends are or benchmarks are. And I'm sure that, you know, there must be a lot of information that people could gain on that.
So we're going to come have to wrap up, I think. But I was going to ask before we do, looking back over your career, what do you think has been the biggest or maybe best decision that you ever made?
Well, I have to say, going into the creative sector, I'd been working in recruitment for 20 years before that, on the high street for the first 10 years, and in specialist in the healthcare sector and social care, which was actually quite challenging because, you know, that was really quite important, you know, because, it was providing qualified social workers that could have impact on, you know, people's lives in a really significant way. So it was quite serious in many respects. And then coming into creative, I just sold a healthcare business and had an opportunity to buy in to the business that I took on. And I loved it from day one. I felt exactly the same way I did as when I first got into recruitment, which I equally loved from the minute I came in. I'm very fortunate, 30 odd years, and I've only ever, for a period of about 18 months in a sector I won't mention, loved every minute of what I'm doing. And majority of the time really enjoyed working with the people.
Do you think there's a uniqueness around that sort of creative digital tech space?
I think so. I think, and also it's a bit more relaxed. It's not stuffy like finance you mentioned earlier. It's not suited and booted. It's a little bit more relaxed. I think people are generally a bit more open because they are more of the artistic, creative nature anyway. It's not the same necessarily for the techies, the real techies, but generally people are a little bit sort of warmer, and it's a much more fun atmosphere. It just suits my personality better.
Oh, well, that's a nice kind of little warm glow to end on, maybe. So Sue, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been really interesting
kind of getting some of your insights. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. We really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.